Take your Bibles this morning and open up to Jeremiah chapter 16. I'm not going to give a huge overview to this section of the book, but we're kind of sort of moving on to a new section. Most of the book of Jeremiah, chapters 2 through 45, are all focused on Jeremiah's message to the people of Judah specifically, and it kind of breaks up into a couple major sections. The first major section of that part of his message is his indictment against the people of Judah. He focuses on two major things that he returns to in almost every message. What's going to happen to them and why? And he goes back and forth. Sometimes the why is specific, sometimes it's general. And says, because of your sin, because of the way you have chosen to live, because of your idolatry, because of your wickedness, because of your refusal to return, then judgment's coming now. And he returns to those two themes throughout. Now, this next section of the book, chapter 16 through 29, is going to be a general overview of different people's responses to this. Maybe Jeremiah's response, maybe the people's response, other prophets' response, the king's response. And so it's going to be very similar to some of the things we've been seeing recently, but we're going to see a different way that he's going to illustrate this point. Did everybody get a handout, actually? Did everybody get a handout as we got in? If you didn't, raise your hand. We want to make sure you got one. All right, I think we're good. Oh, right here in the front, Miss Shirley. In the middle. Thank you. Glad I asked. All right, but in chapter 16, what we're going to see, I gave you a brief sort of outline of everything that happens in chapter 16 through 29. Just so that we know where we're going, what we're doing. And I categorized what it's going to be. Either it's a general illustration. When Jeremiah gives an illustration, he's not giving a sermon. He does an outward visual of the point he's trying to make. So he's either getting an illustration or a sermon of some kind, just giving a message to the people. And in this, sometimes there's a story of something that took place in Jeremiah's life. And the very last thing he does is he actually writes a letter to some of the people who've been taken captive. So we'll see those. I won't walk through them, but we'll see them as we go along. But in chapter 16 and 17, and really half of 17, we see his first point. I called it abstinence because he abstains from several things. And I can say that, but I think it's going to be hard to follow unless we just read the chapter. So this first sermon, this first illustration he gives is from chapter 16 through the middle of chapter 17. And I think the most beneficial thing for us to do is read our passage this morning, which is going to be all chapter 16. So let's do that so we have it in our mind, and then we'll get into it. I actually have a simple sermon with 2 points. Ha! Fancy that. And only a little bit on the one page. So we'll try to make it more complicated than it needs to be. But I want to give us a little background. So Jeremiah chapter 16, let's start in verse number 1. He's still in the middle of explaining these things to these people, but this time God tells Jeremiah to do something to illustrate the point. So verse number 1, the word of the Lord came also unto me, saying, thou shalt not take thee a wife, neither shalt thou have sons or daughters in this place. For thus saith the Lord concerning the sons and concerning the daughters that are born in this place, and concerning their mothers that bear them, and concerning their fathers that begat them in this land, they shall die of grievous deaths. They shall not be lamented, neither shall they be buried, but they shall be as dung upon the face of the earth, and they shall be consumed by the sword and by famine. And their carcasses shall be meat for the fowls of heaven and for the beasts of the earth. For thus saith the Lord, then he goes on to a second thing he tells Jeremiah to do. Enter not into the house of mourning, neither go to lament or bemoan them. For I have taken away my peace from this people, saith the Lord, even loving kindness and mercies. Both the great and the small shall die in this land. They shall not be buried, neither shall men lament for them, or cut themselves, or make themselves bald for them. Neither shall men tear themselves for them in mourning, to comfort them for the dead. Neither shall men give them the cup of consolation to drink for their father or for their mother. The next thing he tells them to do, thou shalt not also go into the house of feasting, to sit with them, to eat and to drink. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will cause to cease out of this place in your eyes and in your days the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness and the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride. Now, actually, let's stop there because I don't want to take the whole time to do that. We're going to get to the second half, but that'll give us a good overview. What he does in the beginning of this book, The first thing he tells Jeremiah to do in this passage, he's told by God as a sign to the people of Judah that he's not going to participate in the regular ways of living that the people around him will. The way the people around him live their daily lives, the way that people normally do things, he is not supposed to do those as a sign to the people to show them that it will very soon be that they will not be able to live the normal ways of life either. We'll see that here in just a minute. We all know people who just don't like to do stuff. You know, they want to try something new, go somewhere, go out, or do something that's out of their ordinary, and they're like, nah, I don't feel like it. And we all know that we all know those types of people, but we also know people who can't do regular things. Maybe they're handicapped and they can't go out. When my wife and I were in Ireland, we were in probably, there's castles everywhere in Ireland, so much so that they don't even care anymore that there's a castle. They just build around it. But we were in, the coolest castle that we were in was like a stereotypical castle, like stone corridors and circular stairways and turrets and those little slits where the arrows go out. So I thought it was great fun. But I felt so bad because you can't make a castle handicap accessible. It is what it is, you know? And there was a couple there who was visiting. And they were tourists, and they had the map, and they had paid admission, and he was wheeling his wife or girlfriend around. And they were going to see what they could do and what they couldn't do. And they'd go somewhere and say, well, I guess this is the furthest we could go here, and I guess this is the farthest you can go here. And you feel so bad for those people because there's some things that they can't do because something has happened in their life that now they're unable to participate in the normal ways that people could live. And this is why we're so careful with our kids, right? We're kind of alarmistic when our children are like climbing on the monkey bars or they're climbing up really high. We say, oh, be very careful because you might fall and then you won't be able to do. And then we list the things that they like to do because if something happens to them, then they will have stopped being able to live their normal life. This is what Jeremiah's illustration truly is. He says, because of the decisions you made, Israel, not just because of an accident, not just because of the way things happen to have been, but because of your decisions, the normal ways of life, the things that you just do because you're a person and living life the way that we would normally do so, you will no longer be able to do that anymore. You have handicapped yourself where what would be common to you is no longer. People don't want to lose out on what life could give them or enjoyment. I just said last week, people don't choose misery and reject joy. They just often don't choose God and they reject him. And they end up rejecting the joy that comes with him. And this is what Jeremiah is illustrating for them. We often, in our lives, because we choose to live as we please, we are choosing to abstain from the joy that God wants to give us in life. And we're going to see that here in just a minute. And so the question that we have for us this morning is, are you handicapping your own joy? Are you handicapping your own joy? And Jeremiah's life was to serve as an illustration to something that they would have to experience very soon. So I'm going to give you 2 points this morning. One is going to be negative, the other one's going to be a positive. So we'll start with the first one first because that's what comes first. So number one, sin disrupts the life that could have been. Sin disrupts the life that could have been. Just read the first 9 verses, which is because I want you to see what was building up to what I'm about to read. And so we're going to come back to those first 9 verses because I just read through them, so you saw them. And we saw Jeremiah not doing several things. And he tells us why. We're going to come back to them. But just as Jeremiah always does in each one of his sermons, he returns to the same 2 points. What is going to happen in their life and why? And this is what he does here. At the very end of telling him all the effects of their sin, he's going to give them the cause of it all. He's going to tell them that it was their choices. So look at verse number 10, and we'll read down to verse number 13. Verse number 10, I want us to start with this because this is the reason why. God's not just being unfairly malicious just to make their life more difficult than it needs to be just because. And that's what we often say to God when our lives are not what we wanted to be. We blame him, like he just decided to get up one morning and say, let's make their life difficult today. And that's not what's happening here. And so that's what he explains. So look at verse number 10. It shall come to pass when thou shalt show this people all these words, and they shall say unto thee, wherefore hath the Lord pronounced all this great evil against us? Or what is our iniquity? Or what is our sin that we've committed against the Lord God? What's this about? Where is this coming from? I have no idea, the people will say. He'll remind them, 11, then shalt thou say to them, because your fathers have forsaken me, saith the Lord, and have walked after other gods, and have served them, and have worshipped them, and have forsaken me, and have not kept my law, and ye have done worse than your fathers. For behold, ye walk every one after the imagination of his evil heart, that they may not hearken unto me. Therefore will I cast you out of this land into a land that ye know not, neither ye nor your fathers, and there shall ye serve other gods day and night, where I will not show you favor. So he tells them, these things are not happening because I've just decided them. You have forsaken me. You've served. You've trusted other gods. You've not kept my law. You've walked after the imaginations of your wicked hearts. You have seen all the failures of the past, and rather than choosing to do different, you've chosen to repeat them. You've chosen to build on the sin. That's what every generation, that's the decision that every generation makes, don't they? Either we choose to build on sin another layer, or we choose to reject it and go a different way. And we say, well, we always build. We don't always build. We've seen many generations in our history that have said, wow, what we have done in the past has been horrendous. We will choose to go a different way. That's what happened during the Civil War. They look back and they said, wow, all of this is bad. We will choose to go a different way. But recently, we've not been doing that, have we? Recently, we've just been building another layer on top. He says, you saw it. You chose to keep going. And sometimes we become so fatalistic, don't we? Well, this is just the way the world is, you know? Just what happens now is just bad. Well, that is the way things are. But why? Why are they that way? Why is the world falling apart? I was like, well, things are just bad. Well, why are they bad? And I get it. I get it. It's easier for a society to get pulled down than to live righteously. It's obviously easier. The natural flow of this fallen world is to plummet into sin because our natural inclinations, our natural man wants to please our flesh. You dump a bunch of people pleasing their flesh into the same society, then the society just plummets together. So in that way, sin is a lot like gravity. If you don't do anything, it will fall. If you just leave it to its own devices, you don't choose to counteract it, that's what will happen. People don't naturally become godly. They become godly on purpose. But when we have gravity in our life, we don't just say, oh, man, well, I guess I need a new pen. You know, because we okay, that happened, but every day we counteract the natural way that things go. When the world brings things down, we have to purposely pull it up. If we never counteracted gravity, then we'd have to constantly buy a new pen every time we dropped one. The same thing with our decisions. Naturally, things will fall. We have to choose to counteract it. We have to choose to go the other direction, and it has to be on purpose. And he's saying, so yeah, I know this is the way things are going, but you have not chosen purposely to go the other way. This has been your choice. And so how has it disrupted our life? Jeremiah gives three illustrations. He does it in his own life. Now, before I say anything else, I want you to recognize that this is an illustration that God told Jeremiah the prophet to have in his life to show his people. This is not normative for all followers of God for the rest of forever, okay? He is not telling us to not get married and have kids. He's not telling us to refuse to go to funerals or to refuse to go to parties. Those are the three things that Jeremiah was told to do personally. So don't pull out of my message today, Pastor Nathan told me I'm not allowed to go to your funeral because that's against the word of the Lord. That is not what I'm saying. You didn't hear me say that. But this is something Jeremiah was told to do to illustrate what would be their experience soon. So I'm going to give you 3 points, but the points are going to be worded in such a way of what they're supposed to learn from it. What's the first way that sin is going to disrupt their disrupt the life that could have been? Number one, your family loses their potential. Their potential. Now, in Jeremiah's situation, it was that they wouldn't have a family at all. So let's go back to the beginning. Verse number one. First thing God told Jeremiah to do was to not take a wife. Verse one, the word of the Lord came also unto me, saying, thou shalt not take thee a wife, neither shalt thou have sons or daughters in this place. For thus saith the Lord concerning the sons and concerning the daughters that are born in this place, and concerning their mothers and their that bear them, concerning their fathers that begat them in this land, they shall die of grievous deaths. They shall not be lamented, neither shall they be buried, but they shall be as dung upon the face of the earth. And they shall be consumed by the sword and by famine, and their carcasses shall be meat for the fowls of heaven and for the beasts of the earth. He's saying that that is what will happen soon. And so he said to Jeremiah, don't marry or have any kids because the future of all women and children in this country is bleak. And very soon, as a sign and a testimony to what will be very soon happening here, don't have a family because there'll come a day where men of Israel will wish that their families did not have to go through what's going to happen in the very near future. Now remember, just like the Israelites, it can be easy to take from that that this is the way the world is. But remember, we just read it a second ago, verse 10 through 13. He finishes this section of three illustrations by saying, this is happening because of your sin. Now, the obvious illustration that we see from this is what so many parents and grandparents think when they have kids. They start thinking about the way they're going to decorate their nursery, and they start thinking about what colors they're going to have, and what they're going to teach their kids, and what they're going to wear, and whether or not they're going to dress them in a bow tie on Sunday morning, because that's cute, and all the things that go along with raising children. But then it crosses their mind at some point, and it crosses the grandparents' mind, especially at some point, what type of world am I going to raise my kids in? And that's true. But remember, this passage didn't say, oh, the world will be bad in general, and so they're going to have to be raised in it. This passage said, the world will soon be a bad place for your families to be because you have made it that way. So the application for us isn't, don't have kids because the world out there is bad. The application for us, am I introducing sin into my life and into my home in so much that my family's future will be handicapped because I have brought in problems that didn't need to be there? Have my decisions ruined my family's potential? Have I taken away from what my marriage could have been? Have I taken away from the life that my kids could have had? Because it's so easy to sit back and say, man, if everyone else in the world was better, then my kids would have a good future. And there's truth to that. But we can't make all their decisions out there. But there's so many Christian families who spend their whole life complaining about everyone else, and then they go home and their own house, the part that they actually have control over, the walls that they actually have the influence of what happens and what doesn't happen and what we introduce and what we keep out, that is their own little space that God's given to them, and they don't protect that. And sometimes their own family's potential is ruined, not because of them out there, but because of us in here. Maybe it's the parents who choose not to make God a priority, and now their kids don't even know how to develop a relationship with God. They don't even know how to do it, or they don't know how to live relying on him. They only know how to live without him. Maybe it's the parent who has made some fleshly decisions, and so they lose their job or go to prison. They make the future significantly more complicated than God wanted it to be. Now, this is not saying that God doesn't have redemption and that God can't turn these things around. In fact, that's how the end of this chapter goes. But we all have to admit that there was complications that were not necessary, that our own decisions introduced. Maybe it's the father or mother who cheats on their spouse, either physically or emotionally, and now the cohesion of their family begins to crumble. Their sin, their idolatry, their lust of their flesh, them following the imaginations of their heart, have caused it so that their wife and kids will not have the future they could have. Easy to read that and say, oh yeah, what kind of world is it going to be? But he says, no, because you have forsaken me, your wives and your kids won't have the future that they should have had. Yes, the world is bad, but let us remind ourselves about the walls that we live in and whether or not my decisions are ruining the future for my family. Sin disrupts the life that could have been. Letter B. Next illustration. How else does it do that? Sorrow is more common than it ought to be. Sorrow is more common than it ought to be. So, next illustration. Don't take a wife and kids, because there's going to come a time very soon where fathers will wish their wives and children won't have to go through what will take place because of their sin. Next, he tells him not to go to any funerals anymore. By the way, our fellows are coming by. If you could take that attendance slip, do us a favor. Just scratch your name on it. We just want to take attendance, have a good idea of how many people we have in here. And when they come by with the offering plate, just drop that in so we know who's here this morning. That would be great. Verse number 5. For thus saith the Lord. Next thing. Enter ye not into the house of mourning. That's the place where they would go when somebody dies. Okay? Funeral. Neither go to lament or bemoan them. For I've taken away my peace from this people, saith the Lord, even loving kindness and mercies. But the great and small shall die in this land, and they shall not be buried. Neither shall men lament for them, or cut themselves, or make themselves bald for them. Neither shall men tear themselves for them in mourning, to comfort them for the dead. Neither shall men give them the cup of consolation to drink for their father or for their mother. So after his first sign, he tells them not to go to a funeral, not to weep, and not to mourn for people who have been lost. Remember, just like not having a wife and kids is not normative for the rest of people who follow God, he's not making this a normative thing. Don't go to funerals. He's not saying that to us. Jeremiah, specifically, was doing that as a sign to the people there. Why? That seems odd, doesn't it? Don't go to a funeral. Do you not care about the people? He's using it as a sign for what will soon be. What could possibly cause it to be that we will not go to funerals? How is that part of our future? He tells us. He says, because so many people soon, small and great, there will be so many people who will die. We will not have a funeral for every one of them. I mean, think about a funeral you've been to. It takes up a week or two of planning. And then you have the funeral itself, which consumes the whole day. Imagine if thousands of people you are close to all died in the same 2 weeks. Will you have a funeral for all of them the same way that you would have? You can't. I mean, think about the Civil War. Think about that. Guys were, well, let's just find a hole. We would have mass funerals where we would mourn for all of them. And he says, you are quickly getting to the point, watch, where sorrow will be so common that a single instance of sorrow doesn't stand out anymore. That's what he's saying. He's not saying the people aren't important. He's just saying there will be so much problems that you can't focus on one of them anymore because there's just too much sorrow to focus on one over the other. And he talks about the different ways of mourning, weeping, lamenting for them. In those cultures, especially in the East, it was it was customary, almost required, that you wept at a funeral. Not like you would go in and you would cry and you hold it back. No, you would wail. Like, that's why they would often, if there was a whole lot of people who liked the person, they would hire mourners to come and to wail and, like, actually wail. That's actually a thing to this day in certain cultures, where people will cry out loud for the loss of this loved one because we thought we were respecting them more that way. He labels a few pagan practices of mourning as well, like cutting yourself or tearing yourself or even drinking afterwards in order to drown your sorrows. He says none of that is going to be able to be specified for any one individual because there'll be so many problems. Now, there's a sense in which what he's saying here is we become desensitized to the problems of life. There is a sense in which mourning is good, because if we have enough time to mourn over something, that means God's blessed us enough that it's not just there's so much of it that it becomes commonplace. And he's saying you'll have no time to mourn because sorrow will be so commonplace. You'll begin to have a high pain tolerance because you'll have a lot of pain. I don't have a high pain tolerance. If somebody tortures me asking me for information, they're going to get it all. And some people do, but some people have emotionally high pain tolerance. I mean, Brother Carl could say this too. You know, sometimes you pick up kids on the bus, or you have kids in your kids club or in your youth group, and they start, and you talk to them about their life, and they'll tell you stuff about their life. Like, yeah, my parents split up again, and we didn't have enough money for food, or, you know, they just got out of jail or just went into jail, and they say it so nonchalantly. Like, in passing, hey, can I have candy? Right afterwards. Just, like, it's just part of conversation. Why? Because that's just the way life is. Contention and arguments at home, that's just the way life is, you know? That's just how we talk to each other. We're always mad at each other. That's just how things are. And after a while, it doesn't bother them anymore, which is so sad that sorrow is so normal. This is what he says here. This is what Jeremiah is saying. When you add sin into your life, you make sorrow more common than it needed to be. You make your lives consistently problematic, where nothing stands out anymore. Hey, when you have a slight disagreement with your wife and it bothers you and you can't get to the end of the evening without resolving it, that's a good thing, because that means it's uncommon. But there's some spouses and they never don't have problems. So as long as the problems aren't terrible and I didn't throw a plate at them, it was a good day. And he said, if something stands out, that's good. When everything becomes normal, that means you're introducing things into your life that you're becoming desensitized to. You're developing a high pain tolerance that I didn't require you to have. Sorrow becomes more common. See, joy is scarcer than it would have been. By the way, I really wanted to write more scarce, but Word didn't like that, so I think it actually is scarcer. So for those of you who question that, I did a little research. That's the comparative. Joy is more scarce than it should have been. It's scarcer than it should have been. So it goes to the next thing. So don't take a wife and kids, because very soon the families in your neighborhoods will wish their wives and kids would not have had to go through what you're about to experience. Don't go to a funeral as a sign that very soon your community won't have time for a funeral to mourn individual loss. Then he tells them not to go to a party. The opposite. Verse number eight. Thou shalt not also go into the house of feasting to sit with them to eat and to drink. Why? Because very soon you will not have time to feast. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will cause to cease out of this place in your eyes and in your days the voice of mirth. Mirth is an interesting old word. It has the idea of not frivolity in the negative sense, but frivolity in the positive sense. We just had a good time. We had joy. We had a party. We laughed. We sang. We danced. That's the idea of mirth. There won't be the voice of mirth, the voice of gladness, or the voice of the bridegroom and the bride. You go to a wedding. Picture a wedding day, good illustration of a good party. We all get together, we all cry because we're all happy and everything's good and new lives are starting, and then we go and we eat food and we play music and we spend time with family, and it's just a good day. And you go to sleep at the end of the night, it's just like, oh, what a happy day. He says, you're not having those days soon. And Jeremiah is assigned to the people, wouldn't attend those, as assigned to say, those are going to go away. Because there won't, just like there won't be funerals where there's a, because there's a abundance of sorrow, due to that abundance of sorrow, there will be no place for joy. We've all been to a, this is a good way to think of it. We've all been to a funeral where we understand, you know, even if we can laugh here and there, you can joke with your family and friends a little, there is a understanding that the amount of joy we're even like able to or even allowed to have is capped at a significantly lower level than a normal day. We all know what that is. There's a code that you can't enjoy that day too much. And you not only shouldn't you, but you really can't. Because of the sorrow of the day, there's only so much joy you can have. It's capped off. Way lower than it should be. This is what he's saying. Your society is getting to a point where the amount of joy that you really should or even can experience is going to be capped. I mean, think about the situation you just described a second ago, where so many people will be lost. We won't have enough place to bury them. There'll be so much sorrow. There'll be war. There'll be desolation. When are you planning a party? When's the next time you're going to have everybody come over to your house for a barbecue? When does that get on the calendar? He says you're going to come quickly to the point that that's not part of your life. Your life is filled with cleaning up. Your life is filled just trying to bring things back to normal. You didn't have a party where you had feasting and dancing. People aren't scheduling a wedding for next week either. And it says, that's what you have introduced into your life. You, your decisions have capped the amount of joy your family and your communities are able to experience. And like I said, yes, our world really caps joy off. I mean, we can't hardly have just enjoy people anymore, right? Every person is labeled by whether or not they're our friend or our enemy, you know? But do they agree with us on everything? Do I like you or not? And there's just constant contention with the world around us. And so we can complain about that, and that would be true. But remember, he says, this is because of your decision. So we have to ask the question, am I, because of my sin, allowing the amount of joy my family can experience to be capped lower than it should be? I mean, this is Father's Day. And fathers who biblically should be the head of the homes should be thinking about the decisions they are making and whether or not they are ruining their own family's potential, whether or not they are making their lives more sorrowful than it needed to be, whether or not they are making it so that joy can really only reach a certain level before it seems almost disrespectful to what your family is going through, but it's only going through it because of the decisions you've been making. He says, sin disrupts life the way that it should be. And everyone's going to be walking down the streets and thinking, what's Jeremiah's problem? Won't marry anybody, won't have any kids. He doesn't go to anybody's funeral. He never goes to any parties. What's his problem? How could you live like that? How indeed. And very soon they will see what Jeremiah did as a sign to us, we all have to do because of what we've chosen to be. So that's the negative point. Number two, he finishes the chapter by saying this, the harder you fall, the greater the witness to God's glory when you rise. The harder you fall, the greater the witness to God's glory when you rise. When your life falls apart and you hit rock bottom, the extent that sorrow is normal, joy is scarce, much of your potential of your future is forfeited. In those situations is when God's grace shines even brighter. When God helps people's lives that haven't fallen apart, it's good. And God's glory can be shown in their life all the time. And so that's a witness to God's glory. But what he shows in this chapter is something that's very often for Jeremiah because he's more of a judgment prophet. But he reminds them that, yes, this is coming in your future. For some of us, maybe that's something we have had in our past. Maybe we would say, wow, I did really change the potential for my family. I really made sorrow more common than it should have been. I capped the joy in my family. Maybe that's something we have had. And then we can get into the spot where it's like, well, now it's done. What's really cool about the story of Israel is that the Old Testament, if it's anything, it's a story of Israel failing most of the time. And yet the fact that the covenants that God made with the people of Israel are still true show us that no matter how much we fail God, he is always willing to meet us where we are. And this is what he says here. After all of that, after what we just read, after how bad the first part of chapter 16 was, he switches tones and he moves to their future. Not their immediate future, but their future down the road. Look at verse number 14. Therefore, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that it shall no more be said, the Lord liveth, that brought up the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but the Lord liveth, that brought up the children of Israel from the land of the north and from all the lands which he had driven them, and I will bring them again into their land that I gave unto their fathers. Behold, I will. Why does that have to happen? Because there's going to be problems in their near future. I will send many fishers, saith the Lord. They shall fish them. After will I send them many hunters. They shall hunt them from every mountain, from every hill, and out of the holes of the rock. Mine eyes are upon all their ways. They are not hid from my face, neither is their iniquity hid from mine eyes. First, I will recompense their iniquity and their sin double, because they have defiled my land, and they filled my inheritance with the carcasses of their detestable and abominable things. Now, he puts this kind of out of order. He reminds them that the reason this bad situation is coming is because of all their sin. And so he says there at the end, he says, because of their sin, send after them fishers and hunters, pictures of those that go to catch the fish, catch the animal. He says those nations that are coming to hunt you, and they will. And why are they doing that? Because of your sin, because of those abominable things that you've brought into your life. But he says, in the future, no longer will we say, the Lord lives, who brought us out of the nation of Egypt. Now, when we read through the prophets and through the books of history, that's usually how God is identified, isn't he? I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And always goes back to that. Now, why? Why? A lot of reasons. One is that it has shown God's power. At their lowest point, they were made a nation. And he refers back to that glorious moment of redemption to say, if I could do that then I can help you now. If I can do that then, I'm worthy to be listened to. If I can do that then, I'm worthy to be obeyed. I am the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. I live. He says, no, but we're not going to call him that anymore. Because very soon, that's not going to be our point of reference. Very soon, we're going to say, the Lord liveth that brought us back from the nations of the north and from all the nations round about. He says, very soon, you're going to be taken away, but I will bring you back. And that will be your point of reference. It won't be something so long ago. It'll be something that I recently have done. And that will be your point of reference for the future after you. It says, God can be involved in my life in a meaningful way because he also did this. Now, why is that important? Because he's saying this terrible thing that you have allowed into your life, I will be there to help you out of it. And you will see that for the rest of your history as a sign of my ability to be there for you, to help you, to redeem you. So it's a sign, two things. It's a sign for yourself. Letter A. It's a sign for yourself. This was going to be their history. It was going to be in their life. God brings us through hard times When joy has been capped, sorrow's too familiar, our family takes a step back, but he wants us to see redemption in it as well. He wants us to see that he lives and he works, and that the harder we fall sometimes can be the best stories of redemption. Think about Paul. He was a murderer of Christians, and then he was an apostle of the church. Think about Rahab. Rahab the harlot, and then she chose to join Israel. That alone is significant. She became part of the people of God. She accepted it for herself. But beyond that, she became part of the lineage of David and of Jesus himself. And so God, we can use those people as stories that no matter where you have been or what you have done or how hard you have fallen, we can use what God does in our life as a reference to say God lives and he works. So it's for us. When we make mistakes, and we all do, and maybe they're to different degrees, maybe we have suffered different amount of consequences, maybe we allow it to go farther than other people or less, but we can still point back in our own life and say, God lives, who brought me out of that. We all have those points of reference in life. Maybe it's your salvation, like theirs was for Egypt, but maybe it's something way beyond that, where even though you have been saved, you have chosen to go back the way of the world. And so now you're experiencing those same worldly consequences again. But you can point back at that and say, hey, that was a good moment in my life now that God has brought me out of it. And the harder you fall, the more glory it is to God when you rise. But it's not only for you, but letter B, it's also for others. It's for others. The prophets often point out the fact that if the nation of Israel fell, it'd be a really bad testimony to the people around them. And there's a certain level of truth to that. Nathan the prophet, who I'm named after, says to David that the name of God is blasphemed to the Gentiles because of you. And that was true. The things we do take away glory from the Lord in the eyes of people. We can't steal glory from God, but we can make God's name look worse than it is because his name is stamped on us. But those moments of redemption where God brings us out of those things can make God look greater than they expected him to be. Because this is exactly, I wouldn't have made this point because I wouldn't have expected it, but this is exactly how he finishes this chapter. He says, no more will you say, God lives, who brought us out of Egypt, but God lives, who brought us back from the land of the north and from all the nations where we're going to go into captivity. You're going to say that. But then he says, but what will everyone else say? What will they see in that? Well, he tells us here at the end, verse number 19. O Lord, my strength and my fortress and my refuge in the day of affliction. The Gentiles, so everyone who's not us, shall come unto thee from the ends of the earth and shall say, surely our fathers have inherited lies, vanity, and things wherein there is no profit. Shall a man make gods unto himself, and they are no gods? Therefore, behold, I will this once cause them to know. I will cause them to know mine hand and my might, and they shall know that my name is the Lord. There's two applications to this. The one is more prophetic. Eventually, God will bring all of Israel back to his land, and that's more of an end times thing. And additionally, it's more prophetic to say that Gentiles will be brought to him and to see him as the only true God. And Lighthouse Baptist Church is an example of that being fulfilled, a room full of Gentiles who have come to see the Lord for who he is. But there's an immediate fulfillment to what Jeremiah is saying as well, that after 70 years, I will bring Israel back to this land. And at that time, the nations around us will look and they will say a couple things. They will see how powerful the Lord is to preserve a people who has fallen that low. And this is what they'll conclude. Those people who live without God will look at their own life and say, wow, I've inherited lies. I've been taught vanity. I have been told to worship gods that are no gods. And he says, I will let them know my hand, my might. He says, when God works in you at your lowest point to bring you back to himself, the people around you see in their life that they don't have a God like that. And that they have been told to trust in things that are not trustworthy. Your life may have significantly more unnecessary sorrow and limited joy than it needed to be because we're sinners. But it is true that every failure in our life can be turned into a story of redemption to the glory of the Lord. The unsaved world around us should see the goodness of God in our life and be able to say that they have inherited lies and vanity, things that have no profit. And so they should be able to look at your life and say, I don't want to end up where I'm going, but I want what you have. Because even though you failed, God brought you back, and I failed, and so I want a God like that. Jeremiah says to these people, it's a bad future, but you know what? God's going to do something good out of it if you let him use that. So the abstinence of our prophet. We abstain from joy more than we should, but God says use it and allow him to bring you out on the other side because he can.